good evening, everyone. My name is Michelle Bolden Hammond, and I'm glad you're here tonight to Upfront Mind, Body, and Soul podcast. We have a very special guest that's joining us tonight, Miss Omika Jackson. I'm excited because, you know, this month is Mental Health Awareness, and what better way to bring as a source for our community, I'm bringing it in from a professional who knows the things that we need as our black for our black community and our mental health. So before I come in, I'm going to give you an introduction of this fine young lady. So Ms. Omika Jackson is a licensed clinical professional counselor and owner of Harvesting Hope Youth and Family Wellness LLC in Dorchester County, Maryland. She received her Associates of Arts from Springfield Technical Community College, her Bachelor's of Science from University of Maryland, and her Master's of Arts from Liberty University. Harvesting Hope Youth and Family Wellness LLC is a nonprofit 501c3 behavioral health and youth and family development agency. Ms. Jackson provides behavioral health services to children, adolescents, teens, adults, seniors, and couples. That also includes individual, family, and group counseling. Programs under the Youth and Family Development include mentoring, literacy, youth reading, socials, youth peer leadership, and youth job training program. Ms. Jackson provides psychoeducation, career development, and self-care presentations, as well as self-care retreats. The highlight of the third year for her mentoring program was touring the White House while President Obama was in office. She has worked with youth and families for over 27 years. She has had positions of youth leader, youth counselor, peer leader, lead counselors, and etc. Her work experiences include the educational systems, nonprofits, residential treatments. Ms. Jackson was also a realtor. Ms. Jackson has successfully completed four books and has published one of her own, which is called Mrs. Ann Meets Mrs. Jones, a foster care book for children. So, Ms. Omika, I want to thank you for joining in on Upfront Mind, Body, and Soul tonight. So, you know, I'm so special and honored to have you here. I appreciate you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. You know, with our relationship, you call, I answer. And I'm glad that you call on me. Thank you so much.
And, you know, we both are in the professions of mental health. And, you know, one of the things that I see alters one of our in our community is, you know, the mental health. So, you know, with tonight's topic, addressing it, I have a couple of questions to say, what are we not doing in our black communities with mental health? And we know that there are certain things that are being problematic in our communities. About it. So the first question that I have to ask, do you believe that there are systematic barriers that impact mental health in the black community? And if so, primarily, what are the factors associated with this?
The answer to that is yes. The systemic issues are far and wide. Racial being one of them, of the professionals in our career field, we're only about 3% of the mental health population. At one point, we were like 2. I think recently we've climbed up 1%, so about 3. So for every 100, white therapist, it would only be 3 of us. And we don't, you know, have a good history with the Caucasian population for the most part when we look at systems from the justice system to social services, medical, and things like that. We don't get the support and care that we need. It's not taken as serious. They're not necessarily agencies within our communities. We're not educated on it. And when it's brought to our attention, it's something we shun. But the trust factor is the main one. I can't come to you and tell you my problems because you're going to take that information and share it, and I'm going to be punished for it. And that's not the case. But, you know, when we share typically in other areas, we're punished for sharing the information to the people who are supposed to support us. So we tend to keep that to ourselves, and we don't trust that, you know, they're going to have our best interests at heart.
And, you know, Amika, that is so true, because when we look at back to when they're talking about the barriers, a lot is the trust issue, because if you look at it, you know, we look at the Tuskegee Air, you know, all of that type of stuff, those different types of genres where they was in, you know, given the syphilis vaccine and then didn't get the help, you know, that they need. So, you know, that dates back to history. So along, this is like a big problem. A trust factor. And then most recently, the study has gone back to, there is a healthcare provider like in New York where they're being sued due to the fact of disparities within the Black community dealing with mental health or any type of other things where they symptomatically just didn't give them, you know, the treatment for the diabetes or whatever, they denied it because of the factor of them being African-American, Black, or, you know, whatever. Right. So, again, it's making me wonder, do you think because of this outbreak is so bad in New York is because they weren't getting the proper care, you know, of the health portion of it? So that is so good. Yeah. That is a true factor about it being a issue of trust. So, you know, one of the things in our community they often talk about is, you know, what stays in the home, you know, we don't talk about, you know, what goes on here stays here. And, you know, back in the day, if Aunt JoJo was acting a certain way, we just ignored it. But they didn't want to talk about, you know, she, you know, had a mental health problem. We, now that I'm older, I can see that some of my relatives have. So in our community, what do you think about the stigma associated with mental health and how we, as a community, can bring forth the message of mental health wellness?
The stigma is it runs deep. It runs religiously, meaning that so many of our churches preach and teach that mental health issues come from not having faith in a relationship with God, and that's not true. I am not a Bible thumper, and people know that, but I went to one of the most religious schools to get my master's degree, and that's Liberty University, and them some Bible thumpers. However, one of the things that I was, you know, so happy about that program is that there was that integration piece. And right. The one thing that they stood on was that do not tell people that they have mental illness because they don't believe in God, or that right. they're not, you know, sowing, you know, into the church and relationships and things like that. That's one thing that they definitely discussed, and every other school of thought has that when it comes to mental health issues. Now, your spiritual practice and your religious beliefs are important in maintaining that. However, not having those things does not mean that's the reason why you have a mental health issue. The other part is there are so many layers that come with mental health. People don't understand poverty creates mental health issues. Medical issues create mental health issues. Physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, you know, witnessing violence, even though you're not the one who is the victim, but I can be looking out my window and see it, that I can get post-traumatic stress from that moving around a lot, you know, not having a stable home environment because I'm moving a lot. That can create anxiety and adjustment disorders. And those are the things that we're not educated on.
Exactly.
You know, we're not, nobody is educating us as a whole on what mental health is. And a lot of, you know, the white community don't know either. It used to just be a privileged white person's thing, you know, and they just went to go talk about their rich people problems. Rich people have mental health issues just like everybody else. Just because they have money doesn't mean that life doesn't happen to them, that they're not a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, depression, anxiety, death of a loved one. Those things are real. And those are the things that we need to be more apt to discuss and to normalize. You know, when somebody dies, we just ignore it and act like people are supposed to go on, especially the children who are the most vulnerable. Their parent can pass away and we expect them to be back in school, you know, the day after the death, you know, the day after the funeral, and go to school and manage as if their whole life wasn't turned upside down. That is unconscionable. Like, how can you? You know, we need time to grieve. And yeah, we want them to have a normal routine, but let's talk about what they're feeling. Let's give them the time that they need to process all the stuff that has occurred. And we don't do that. And the other part is our mental health is typically pathologized, which means it's seen as criminal. You know, when we think about the symptoms that's in the general book for mental health, it typically is middle-class white males, not white women, but white males. That typically that's what the study is coming from. And so symptoms for everybody shows up differently. But we can still have the same symptom that they have, and ours is just going to be pathologized, like we're, you know, a criminal or a sociopath or a thug, because those are the terms that they use for us,
exactly.
As opposed to this person is experiencing, is in distress because of anxiety or because of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. We're not allowed to feel, you know, we're too angry. And so we stop talking. We're too aggressive, so we don't express ourselves. And that goes back to the systemic piece. That kind of shuts us down. And when we just shut down emotions, they start to show up in our behaviors.
Yeah, that's and what are you saying? Everything that you're saying is so true, because I know I look through the clients that I serve. You know, when we're talking about the mental health is, you know, when you start to speak out as being, you can be in an office setting and speaking, you know, on turn, but then you're the angry black woman. know, it's not taking you in general as, that you are bringing value to this piece of information. But first thing is that we're angry or we're anxious or we're obnoxious, you know, or, you know, different things like that.
So we need to know our place. You know,
right.
We need to know our place. That thing. So very dismissive.
And that is a very good. And one thing I like that you just said in that too, you know, we look at it as, you know, when we're doing the DSM-5s and, you know, different like that. I think there should be something, not that we want to separate, but I think that there's a difference because who made that book? I think there should be some other diagnosis just especially for us because it should be, you know, maybe that's something we can work on together.
That's it. Yeah. Right.
to bring it into where it needs to be, because I know, you know, we both work as partners in this. So the next question, why is it, and I know when you talk about with the educational, because you do a very good outstanding piece on the disparities in, you know, school systems, how the school system treat our African-American children. Why Why is it, and this is a question I know, why is it that most of our African-American children are misdiagnosed or diagnosed with ADHD?
Because that's the easiest diagnosis to give a child, and I don't necessarily have to go into what's really going on with them. And half the people that's diagnosing them aren't trained clinicians. You have classroom aged teachers that don't have the clinical skills to determine that. And the other piece is you're labeling a child with the diagnosis because they won't sit still. Children aren't supposed to sit still. They're not supposed to sit for 4 hours to listen to someone talk, not fidget, not move. That's not even how God made us, right? Kids are supposed to be up and moving. Having them sit like that creates problems. And if I can't sit down, if I can't sit still and I can't manage my behaviors, then you label me as defiant, oppositional defiant, ADHD, as opposed to just being a normal child. But then the other part of that is, again, it goes back to pathology. Our children are pathologized more than anybody. If a white student is struggling in some communities, not all, because, you know, I've seen where, you know, some teachers just don't have the capability, you know, to be in a classroom or it should be in a school setting at all with a white or black child. But typically what tends to happen is they will make excuses for the white child's behavior. Oh, the mom is sick. Oh, the dad is away in the military or whatever the case may be. You know, they woke up on the wrong side of the bed. But for the black child, they're just oppositional. They just want to give me a hard time. They're just disrespectful and don't respect authority. Have you shown them respect? Because children deserve respect too, and you should be modeling to the child what you want back from them. But if you're yelling at them and you're looking at them like you don't like them, the child picks that up. They know that. So when I come to your classroom, I'm going to be anxious. I'm not going to be comfortable. I might even have some depression, so it's going to show up in my behavior because I know you don't want me in your classroom. I can't be comfortable in that setting. Or you don't know if I didn't eat this morning because something happened at my house. My mom had to work overnight. The neighbors, music was on all night, and they were partying and carrying on, and that interrupted my sleep because it doesn't necessarily mean something happened in their household for it to be a problem. It could be the, you know, the environment of the community that disrupted some things for them. And so as opposed to asking what happened or how can I help, we go to judging the behavior and judging the child and judging the parent.
Okay. And so, and you're just leading into the next question. You know, there's a recent study that says 20% of people in the black community are more likely to experience mental health problems. And we do know that some of those associated factors is the social determinants because of poverty. We also know that also drug use is a big substance abuse is one of the factors that with this. But when we're going to seek out treatment and help, you know, for help for those, is it important to have representation of African-American therapists, school counselors, psychiatrists that are in our school systems or, you know, even in our communities? But we know relative, as you said earlier, there is not enough of us in the field that you would know build up that trust issue. So my last point of question is, what would be some of the tips that you would give those in our community when they're trying to seek out a culturally responsive provider?
So there are a couple of sites that you can go to. You can go to Psychology Today and Black Therapists Rock, Black Girls Need Therapy Too. And these are sites where you can actually look up African-American therapists. You could call an agency and ask them, do they have an African-American therapist? And if they do, you can find out if they are the one that's accepting new clients. The other part is parents and community members is making sure that the school staff represents the community that they service. And it's the same thing with doctor's offices and behavioral health agencies. All of them should be a representation of the community. I shouldn't go into a doctor's office that's, you know, mixed in a mixed race community and all the doctors are white. That makes no sense. They need to be more diligent and intentional about bringing people of color into their practices, especially African Americans, because the other piece of that is there's still some strife and disconnect from other cultures of color. So bringing right. in an Indian doctor doesn't mean that you've done a good job, because you don't know the relationship between the two communities or how they view us and how we view them. We need to be very conscious of that works. The other part is us advocating. If you can't get a therapist of color, start interviewing your therapist. You know, go around and interview, just like you would for anything else, because you need to know that it's a good fit. Just because somebody offered you a therapist, it doesn't mean that's the therapist for you. You know, talk to them, fill them out, and see if that's an option. For people who have Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and United, they can do teletherapy, and that's therapy virtually. And with that, you have to stay in the confines of your state based on state mandates, but then you're more apt to be able to identify a therapist of color. So for someone that's on this side of the bridge where we're at on the Eastern Shore, small town, everybody don't want to go to the same therapist. And it might be one black therapist per office, maybe two or three. But they might go to church with you, or their kids go to school with your children. So you decide, you can make the decision to identify a therapist across the bridge, PG County, Montgomery County, Baltimore, Anne Arundel County. You know, we have a lot of African American therapists on that side of the bridge, as well as males. Because that's another issue, not having enough male therapists of color. And there are some male based issues that, you know, I think that men would feel, and I know they would feel more comfortable. Even some of the little boys that I see, I know they will feel more comfortable with, because having adult males talking to females about being molested as a child can be very difficult. And so you want representation across the board. You know, some of these young men don't have men in their lives, and so it's just yet another female in their life that's saving them. Okay. And we need to be aware of that and conscious of that.
Okay. Well, Omika, I want to say I thank you so much for the tips and for sharing and, you know, helping our Black community with mental health. And we know that this month we celebrate mental health awareness. So where can the audience find you? And also where you can search for your books, can you give out that information?
Yes. We can be reached at info@harvestinghopeinc.org. You can go to our website at harvestinghopeinc.org. You can contact me via phone, 443-351-4846. That's to our office. And you can find my book online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other sites would have it. Please do. If you don't have a child that's ever experienced foster care, there are plenty of children who do. And if you want to purchase the book and donate it to your local Department of Social Services, Child Welfare Agency, that would be awesome. The book basically educates children on what foster care is, and it's for readers like 9, 10, and under.
Okay, well, wonderful. So as a call of action to the community, I'm your host, Michelle Bolden-Hammond. Tune in for next week at Upfront Mind, Body, and Soul. We appreciate, you know, be well in our minds, our body, and our souls. So again, thank you so much for joining in and tuning in tonight on Upfront Mind, Body, and Soul. We will see you again next week. Thank you.